Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A common belief about technology is that it always moves forward, leaving behind innovations of previous eras. The digital age was supposed to wipe out things like books, vinyl records, even the need for pen and paper. But recent years have seen a resurgence of many of the analog goods and ideas that had been written off as obsolete. David Sacks writes about this phenomenon in a new book titled The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. He joins us here in the studio. Also with us from a studio at Dartmouth College, Virginia Heffernan. She's author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. I'm sure many of you will want to weigh in. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Diane and David.
David, you call this book The Revenge of Analog. First, I think you need to explain what you mean by analog.
The very layman's definition and the broadest definition that I'm using is essentially what is not digital. If it doesn't need a computer to work, if it doesn't require a processor or the internet, it's analog. And analog represents objects, things like turntables and vinyl records or printed matter, books, physical newspapers, magazines, FM radio. But it can also represent a way of thinking, a way of doing business. So selling things in a store, brick and mortar retail, is, I included the definition of analog, as well as, practices such as teaching in a classroom instead of the notion that, education can be replaced with online classes. So it's a broad layman's definition that I'm sure a lot of electrical engineers would have quibbles with.
And what got you started on this whole idea?
It began about a decade ago, and there were two things that happened in my life at the same time that got me thinking about it. One of which, at the time, around 2007, was that a lot of my friends were getting smartphones for the first time. This was BlackBerries. This is before the iPhone had even come out. And I noticed a very stark change in their behavior. I would be in the middle of a conversation with someone, even if they were driving a car, and they would just stop. Mid-sentence, look down at the phone, and be gone for 10 minutes or so. And at the time, it struck me as this incredibly rude and interesting change. And yet, within a year, I was doing the same thing, and now that's just commonplace. At the same time, my roommate and I at the time, his parents had given us their old turntable and a bunch of their records. And this was right when we had actually just uploaded all our CDs onto iTunes and figured out how to stream them wirelessly through the house. And yet, here we were, each night, sitting down, pulling out, old Neil Diamond albums and Herb Albert albums, and listening to them on this turntable and engaging with it, and really sparked this conversation about how the technology influences the way we perceive the world and the effect it has. And then over the past decade, that became something that, as you were saying in your introduction, became a more common cultural phenomenon. More people began buying vinyl records when, soon after they had sort of been deemed completely obsolete, and they've been growing every year for the past decade, in ways that were even bigger than the decades before. We're seeing sort of a resurgence of print books, and independent bookstores are growing again. And so there's a broader cultural phenomenon that's happening here.
And you regard that as the revenge of analog.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean, I don't mean that in a few years the smartphone will go away and we'll all just go back to,
sure,
writing things on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Your podcast will become an FM radio or an AM radio station again. But what I do mean is that, these things that we had written off for dead, that were supposed to be gone and in the dustbin and completely eradicated by digital technology, are now growing once again and finding sort of a new life.
Virginia Heffernan, have you seen this same phenomenon?
I've absolutely seen it, and it's been sort of extraordinary to watch. I think I sympathize with David when it comes to putting a name on what are those objects that resist digital? What are those objects that I believe defy digital? Revenge is a good word for it, because this is not, there's nothing sort of accidental about this. There's something very almost florid and cartoonish about the things that have returned. For instance, in, you know, what's meant to be hipster Brooklyn in Bushwick, you have people not just going to vinyl, but going to butchering their own meat. You know, this is a time when you want not just a return to 20th century culture like records, but a return to 19th century culture, a return to agrarian culture. And that, I think, is in forceful defiance of some of the limitations, but also kind of grand cultural themes of the internet. I sympathize, though, with David in trying to decide what to call these things. His book is called The Revenge of the Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. Analog is a strange word. Real is a strange word. And things is a strange word. You know, the fact that analog described a progressive new technology, not just reality, but once described, you know, it's not, you don't have to be an engineer to say there were mechanisms that were analog. There were compasses, there were sextants, there were, you know, as they say about ideology, people who resist ideology are sometimes under the spell of a new ideology. People who resist digital technology are sometimes under a spell of an older technology. You know, they miss the printing press, or they miss vinyl, which were very advanced technologies in their day. So this is not just pure Luddism. This is not just a preference for the real over the virtual. This is a love of certain 20th century and 19th century technologies.
On the other hand, here's a website comment, David, which says, moving to digital photography has a big advantage. Does anyone actually have to pay to have their photographs printed anymore? Same with music. I still have all of my vinyl records, but I also copied them to my iPod. The music on my iPod would fill a 12-by-12 room if it were vinyl. So there's that side.
Well, that sounds like a fantastic record collection.
Yeah, you bet.
I think, you know, what that commenter is getting at is the reality of what we're, you know, Virginia and I have observed. And that's the people who are electing to take up analog technologies again, and often these are much younger consumers, right?
Why?
Well, they're doing it for two reasons. One is pleasure, right? For the person who goes out like myself and buys vinyl records, I know that it costs more money, it takes more time and effort, it takes up valuable space in my house that I have to negotiate with my wife for a brand new shelf because I've run out of shelf space for my record collection. But it brings me joy. And it brings me a joy that goes beyond the sonic quality of the music. It is the joy of the tactile experience. The joy of going into a record store when I visit a city and spending an hour in there learning about new bands. In a way that, yes, I could find that same information and music on my Spotify account or by Googling, but it's not as much fun. I can't invite Virginia over to my house and she can't peruse through my iTunes or peruse through my Spotify playlist with a glass of wine in the same way that she can if she comes in and looks at my bookshelf and looks at my record.
And Virginia, you talked about cutting your own meat and going back to the 19th century. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, I mean, one of the things, I was one of the, well, they called them, and I think I can say this on the radio, glass holes, people who used Google Glass, with a short-lived experiment that Google had of wearing the internet basically on your head. And I walked around Brooklyn, and I had people say, you are this bad thing, this jerky thing, this show-off, to my face. And they said, who needs Google Glass when you have handmade ukuleles? Ukuleles. I mean, come on. So, you know, I think one of the things, you know, that we're sort of not saying when we talk about floor space or shelf space is that analog culture, you know, non-digital artifacts, totems of the 19th and 20th century, are expensive. And they are, it's prestigious to own them. You know, the idealized reader of, you know, of great books has a giant library with Moroccan-bound volumes in it. And always there's wine in this story, and you imagine a beautiful wine cellar, or you have the space for vinyl. There's a reason that in small apartments, people really early embraced technology and drove the price cheaper in New York, including synthesizer and sound machines that were, you know, it very soon derided as against the, like, beautiful guitars and drum kits that white kids had and middle class kids had in their garages. And then also headphones, because you have to shut out the noise.
Shutting Out the Noise, Virginia Heffernan. She's the author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. David Sacks is here in the studio. His new book, The Revenge of Analog. We'll take a short break. Your calls when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. Here in the studio, David Sacks. He is author of The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek and New Yorker's Currency Blog. Joining us by ISDN and Skype from Dartmouth College, Virginia Heffernan. She's author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. And before we go on, I want to read you this email from Jenny. She says, here's why the word revenge fits. I don't feel I have had a choice in the way tech is taking over. As a parent, as a human, the seemingly inexorable march toward virtual reality has felt like a crime. It sounds extreme, but I feel something has been stolen from me, and especially my children, digital natives, against my will. So the word revenge makes me happy. And this book, this author, and this show is the best news I've heard in a while. I don't feel so alone. There you go, David.
Thank you, Jenny.
How
that
about
that? That is a publishable paragraph. Yeah. I love that paragraph.
That'll go in the paperback.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll save it for you. Absolutely. Do you think this is a niche thing, or how widespread is this feeling? As you title your book, Magic and Loss, Virginia, how widespread do you feel that loss is?
I mean, as we just had in this brilliant message, we just heard a taste of the kind of grief that has attended the digital revolution. And we've spent the last almost 20 years trying to articulate that grief. What is lost from Kindle books that you find in the moldy bindings of a book from the local library? What is it? Do we really just miss something in the mold? Is there something intrinsically preferable to vinyl with that sort of dusty, hairy sound of the needle hitting the record? You know, that it's not it's not the march of progress to listen to that muddier bass signal on vinyl, and yet we have a longing for it. And techno-utopians will tell you that's nostalgia. They talk like, you know, Bolsheviks when they say, you know, digital is rolling along and forget your old stuff, burn your books, you know, like that 92 Times article. This is the end of books. Give it up. The new regime is here. And that is maddening. And as your writer just said, lots of people feel like they don't have a choice in that. They didn't grow up with it. They have beautiful skills like handwriting or very concerted long attention spans for books. And these things have been devalued. Not only devalued, they're inadmissible in digital culture. And who wouldn't feel left out? Who wouldn't feel left out? And who wouldn't feel a streak of actual palpable pain?
But the one interesting thing that I find is that the market forces that are driving this, if you talk to people in the music industry who work with vinyl records and sell them, if you talk to people in the bookstore, in the independent bookstores that are opening, in the publishing industry, even sort of the new independent magazines and film photography, they say the market that's driving this are not nostalgic baby boomers and people
who fear
the loss of this. It is actually those digital natives, the millennials, the younger people who are not even 10 years old yet, who are the ones who are out buying, asking their Santa for, you know, Fujifilm Instax film cameras for Christmas and turntables and records. And to them, it's not, oh, remember the past as the Bushwick, you know, waxed mustached butchers are doing. To them, it is an entirely new thing. And they're gravitated toward it because it's different than the ubiquitousness of digital. Everybody has an iPhone. There's nothing new to it. There's nothing unique about that.
And Nicola says that vinyl outsold digital music in the UK for the first time last week. So
amazing.
It's not just here in the US, but perhaps at the beginning of a worldwide phenomenon.
This is certainly a global phenomenon, at least in you know, the wealthy world, and obviously wealthy corners of the developing world as well. It's a middle class phenomenon. And while Virginia's right, there is an expense to buying books. There's an expense to buying records. The expense is a relatively modest one. And when you compare it to the expense of having to buy a new $700 phone every couple of years or a new, you know, pair of Google glasses or virtual reality goggles, it is an indulgence in things that will also last, right? The copy of Virginia's book that I have, if I don't burn it by accident or drown it in a fire, it's going to last for many years. My iPhone's going to be useless.
Here's an email from Travis, who says, with digital, we can have more music, more news, etc. Is more better? I think not, he says. Are we failing to curate the best when everything is available? And that takes me back to this whole issue of fake news and how that is proliferating online without our control.
And I think it comes down to a qualitative argument, right? In the world of digital, the great advantage of digital is that you can disseminate, you can copy, you can democratize things. Information, you know, the ones and zeros that are produced by the Washington Post or the New York Times are on your flat screen, on the dashboard of Facebook, no different than that of InfoWars or whatever, you know, Vladimir Putin's latest website is. And so that the idealism that came in the early days of the internet, the utopian ideal that Virginia spoke about before, that, oh, well, this, the internet is going to open it up and everybody will have a word and we'll break down the barriers and you know, it'll be a brave new world, really over the past couple weeks has come back to bite us now. And I think we're realizing the real world consequences of that. The shooting up the street here next to the great bookstore Politics and Prose where I had my event just a few weeks before is just but one example of that.
But now what about, contrarily speaking, Cyber Monday? And you had all these people buying online and breaking records there. So clearly while they may be choosing to go into brick-and-mortar stores and many more being built, you've still got people going online to buy. Virginia.
Well, this is just such an extraordinarily rich topic. I mean, and naturally, a conversation these days, not even, what are we, we're a month out from the election, might start in vinyl, but it's got to end up in Donald Trump, let's face it. So, you know, one of the things that has been interesting about the fake news phenomenon is, and I'm going to get a little schematic here, but I see, you know, it's sort of a commonplace in macro history to describe civilization as a charge, an increasing abstraction. So you go from animal sacrifice to prayer, or gold ingots to finance, to pulses on credit cards, to Bitcoin. And Trump ran on this idea of the return, in some ways, to the real. He's a builder. But what's interesting is he's also a brander. And a lot of the rhetoric around his campaign was about return to the earth, return to the made thing, return to industrialization. Then at the same time, and he was campaigning against finance and against abstraction and against this very rarefied vocabulary of the elites. At the same time, he was very cannily using Twitter and, in some cases, what's now called disparagingly fake news. But let's remember, the fake news readers consider that alt news. They consider that the news that cuts against the dominant narrative, just as the left once thought that they were the antidote to doublespeak. Remember the doublespeak of the Vietnam era, that very concrete language about our bodies and how we, and free speech was being gagged. And all of a sudden, the real story of Vietnam came out over and against this fakey establishment language. So that is a phenomenon of the internet. Absolutely. The first sites I wrote for online, and I always wrote online first, were for places that told indie stories, little memoirs, little alternative stories that you weren't getting from the print paper, the networks, and even NPR. And so, you know, I do think it's an epiphenomenon of the internet that we get something like fake news. At the same time, Joey Ito at the Media Lab says digital might represent progress, you know, or it might represent the next thing, but it's not necessarily a good thing. You know, it could put someone like Donald Trump in power. So, you know, I find that extraordinarily interesting. It's hard to talk about digital without making it sound like it's all good, and it's not all good.
And I think that is one of the bigger forces behind this phenomenon. You know, the narrative of the past decade, let's say the iPhone era, has been very much one that Silicon Valley sort of set the narrative that we are in this wonderful new world and here's all these wonderful things that are going to happen. And, you know, that was everything from the business model. You know, everybody should be their own venture capitalist, angel investor, and invest in startups. And I have done this myself. To the notions of education and art and culture that, you know, if you do something digitally, that is the way forward, and that's the thing. And I think now, having lived with smartphones for a decade, we're coming to a point of maturity where we're seeing where this benefits us as societies, as individuals, as institutions, and where it does have problems, where analog might provide a better solution, or at least a different solution to a certain problem with a different result that might be more appropriate for whatever it is.
Give me an example.
Well, one example, let's go back to retail. You know, you talked about Cyber Monday and the growth in sales. And yet at the same time, you have companies like Warby Parker and Bonobos and Amazon, you know, e-commerce retailers, which were created to disrupt the brick and mortar retail store mm-hmm. by selling products online. They're all now opening stores. Amazon's opened, I think, 3 bookstores in the past year. They're going to open a lot more. They've just launched this new service, Amazon Go, which is going to be sort of a supermarket where you can shoplift the goods out of, I guess, and they'll charge you as you go at the door, and maybe some sort of, you know, explosive equipped drone will prevent you from stealing a cantaloupe or something. But they're not doing this out of nostalgia. They're not doing this to simply advertising the real world. They're doing this because the economic model of e-commerce only retail is very difficult to make a profit from.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to open the phones. We've got some really interesting callers waiting. First to Zachary in Cincinnati, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone. I was just wondering if maybe this resurgence in analog is also due to control. We know for a fact that the NSA is spying on citizens, and we know about digital rights management, and people kind of reject being controlled. I know I do. I've always had vinyls, but my vinyl collection has grown, and I like to be able to share that with somebody, which you can't do with an iTunes song.
Virginia.
We've talked about nostalgia and pleasure and even the sort of perversity of the Bushwick crowd butchering their own meat and turning to flip phones or less technology. And we've talked about the commercial possibilities of objects in three dimensions. But the thing you bring up, the security factor, is really interesting to me. And it really does bias the culture in favor of. So, for instance, Goldman Sachs, you know, caught with emails talking about pumping bad mortgages, turned to this little code, like almost a hashtag, LDL, let's discuss live. Let's drop off email where the things can be searched, subpoenaed, solicited, and turn to live meetings. And when you have live meetings as a way of defying the SEC or whatever reason, the NSA, you end up with more meeting spaces, more movement of bodies by transportation, less telecommuting, and it has big effects. The other thing I love on the security tip is, or interests me, is that the Navy, for fear that GPS technology will be hacked, has started to train sailors on compasses, sextants, and even celestial navigation by the stars. So these analog returns are not just, oh, vinyl sounds warmer, better, I remember it from childhood. These are actual security measures. They're actual measures with commercial and military applications, which really does bias the culture in favor of bias technology in favor of a return to analog. There are a lot of advantages.
Yeah, I interviewed a former Secretary of the Navy here in D.C., as well as some other national security experts for a separate article for Business Week. And, you know, they talked about analog safeguards and critical infrastructure as the power grid, as nuclear power plants, as military systems are all connected to the Internet of Things so they can be controlled from anywhere, that opens a back door that can be very easily hacked by state actors like Russia and China or non-state actors. And so what is now being discussed in a lot of these places is, okay, now can we just interrupt that with a person sitting at a desk with a switch that they have to turn when someone flips a phone so that there is a hard, actual physical firewall there in the system that can prevent a sort of catastrophe.
Here's a contrarian view from Taylor, who says, I understand the resistance to globalization and its digital trappings, but isn't this analog fetish ecologically irresponsible?
I think this is a fascinating point. David, you've really reported on this. And I should say Revenge of the Analog is a brilliantly reported book. This is not just armchair speculation. David has gone and talked to so many people about this. Say something about the environment.
No, say something. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now answered for the sins of all of this. Look, it is, you know, film photography production is one of the most industrially, chemically complex and highly polluting industries. And so when you compare that to, say, Instagram, of course, the ecological footprint is larger. You know, vinyl record productions relies on melting whole bits of petroleum into pieces of music, and then, you know, the world of paper and what it does. It is not without cost.
And we'll get back to more of the cost after we take a short break. Your calls, your comments, stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to two fascinating people about what's happening in this world of analog and digital. David Sacks is the author of The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. Virginia Heffernan, she's on Skype and ISDN from Dartmouth College. She's the author of a book titled Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. Now, I have to read this email from Don, who says, surely the guests are not suggesting that people are replacing digital with analog. I think either or is a false dichotomy. People use both digital and analog depending on their immediate goals and context. A paper book to read in the bathtub, an e-book or smartphone to read in the supermarket checkout line.
That's a very, very long supermarket checkout line. I agree 100%. The either or is the false dichotomy almost presented to us by the language of digital binary, right? It's either a one or a zero, black or white, Apple or Samsung. And the reality is even the prototypical Brooklyn hipster who we mentioned in the beginning, and of course we're just going to keep bringing up because it's always so much fun.
Why not laugh at him? His mustache.
They are taking Instagram photos of their pork butchery class while they go home and will listen to Spotify on the walk home before they go place their album on their turntable.
We're wrong to see that. I mean, I don't know if you agree, but as like let's not say deplorable, despicable hypocrisy, because I think in David, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have this Marshall McLuhan quote at the beginning of your book. A new medium is never an addition to an old one, nor does it leave the old one in peace. It never ceases to oppress the older media until it, and I think that's the older media, finds new shapes and positions for them, or the new media casts old media in new places. I think maybe too positively about this, but I think that dynamic tension between the real and the virtual, between the analog and the digital, is extraordinarily good for the culture. You take something like Amazon. You brought up Amazon. We think of Amazon as digitization that puts bricks and mortar stores out of business. Well, Amazon is responsible more than anything on earth for the circulation of what George Carlin used to call stuff. Right? Stuff that you hold in your dusty little hand. You pay for Amazon Prime to get quick delivery of your mugs and your umbrellas and your flashlights, and then you get free video because nobody will pay for intellectual content anymore. Nobody wants to pay for the print New York Times, which is very expensive to make, or maybe more people now, but not in the past. And yet they will pay $20 for a mug, which costs a vanishingly small amount of money to make now. So, there is the pushback of stuff is in heavy circulation right now. I mean tchotchkes. I mean silly stuff. I've been reading the gift lists for Christmas, and they are just ludicrous suggestions of, like, the next scented candle you need. And then at the same time, we're supposed to be in this, like, all-digital world, and yet all we want to get our little paws on are, little G.I. Joes or whatever.
I think I know what's on your Christmas list, the $20 G.I. Joe.
I wanted to get that in on live radio in case Santa is out there.
I think, that's the interesting thing that you talked about, sort of the idealized virtual apartment of the digital age, right? Someone who gets that, 300 square foot beautiful condominium with the crisp white walls, and you walk in and they have a big screen TV and an Apple TV and a Sonos speaker, and they don't need anything, and it's the most depressing place in the world. And then I contrast that to my friend's house in, I hate to say it, but Brooklyn, where I had Thanksgiving a couple weeks ago, with a fireplace and bookshelves and there were, you know, the steak knives had antlers on them. I mean, it was, you know, it was a horrid issue of Kinfolk gone to seed. And yet, you know, that defines them, right? There's that warmth in that stuff. And I think this kind of idealized post-capitalist digital utopia that we imagined in the past couple of years may not necessarily be what we want. That once we're presented with that, we're like, okay, now what am I going to give Virginia for Christmas? I can't just give her another right. iTunes gift card.
Gift card.
All right.
Says love.
I'm going to open the phones now. First to Meredith in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to say that so much of this discussion and some of the other listener callers have sort of stolen my thunder. But I wanted to ask for you to discuss a little bit maybe some of the opposite of one of the last emails that said that maybe some of this return to analog is actually not eco-friendly. One of the thoughts, I'm loving this discussion, but one of the thoughts that I'm having as I'm listening to you guys is I used to live in Bushwick, and I actually lived there before. It was cool and trendy, and I'm too old and fat to be a hipster now. I'm not that young anymore, and I'm not that cool anymore. But we do things like butcher our own meat or buy really high-quality kitchen utensils that I hope I'll be able to pass on to my daughter. And I don't do it for the same reason that other people wear skinny jeans. I do it because I want to make a positive footprint and impact on the environment. We butcher our own meat or work with local farmers to do it because we think it's important to have high-quality food. And so I wanted to talk about that aspect. We're not all out to stick it to digital, and we're not all in revenge mode. Some of us are really just interested in returning to a time maybe where the quality of our lives was as good or better as it was with all this technology. And so
that's very interesting.
This is really a good point, and we got to lay off those hipster jokes because that is a tiny fragment.
Never
of the
say that. Never say that, Virginia.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I mean, you're right. I'll go back on that probably in the next 5 minutes. But in any case, I do think this is a great point, and this is, you know, urban gardens and you know, people growing their own food and trying to leave a smaller, you know, walking, even moving to cities to, you know, so they don't have to get a Tesla or
sewing their own clothes, doing their own cooking instead of buying it from the already made supermarket
Blue Apron delivery service.
Exactly.
The Blue Apron delivery service, which, like, right, exactly. And I think this is important to bring up that there are, you know, we could go back and forth, and I think probably David has the numbers on this better than I do, but on whether the, you know, more expensive life is the digital or the analog one, and the more, you know, sort of thoughtful and considered. I do think it's important to keep in mind that people in small apartments, and I live in a small apartment in New York, you know, for instance, my parents don't like that my kids are on their tablets. But I would rather not having the floor space. This sounds silly, but I think this plays out. This works writ large too. I would rather have them play the game of life with a spinner and little pieces and whatever, all in digital artifacts, than spread that all out over the floor. And frankly, I don't have the space for tons of shelves of analog of vinyl records or books, nor do I certainly don't have room for like a little group of chamber musicians coming in, or, you know, lots of live music. So, you know, I do think that there's some memories from the 70s of when synthesizer culture belonged to poor people who couldn't afford drums. And the music was condemned as being heartless and tinny. And you see this sometimes in the condemnation of music from Asia as being so technical. And, you know, and I think that there's, you know, honestly, a bit of xenophobia and elitism in that, you know. But then by contrast, you know, nothing saves money like sewing your own clothes and growing your own food. So
David.
I think it cuts both ways.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when it comes to the food thing or the clothes thing, I mean, then we're not talking about analog or digital. It is a much sort of larger cultural movement. And the thing that links them is the quality of the experience, right? There's, before I came on the show, I went to this lovely bakery across the street. What's it called? Bread... Bread something.
Bread First.
Bread First. Incredible.
U-R-S-T.
Yeah. Incredible, right? Art, you know, what is called an artisan bakery, you know, very high
and
price.
That's Mark Furstenberg.
Loaves and incredible babkas.
Like yes.
Just absolutely delicious. And, you know, it reminds me of some of the writing of Michael Pollan in The Omnivore's Dilemma. The idea that, yes, the most, you know, is it more economical and efficient to buy a loaf of Wonder Bread than to buy the, you know, $6 sourdough at Whole Foods or a farmer's market? Of course it is, but you're getting something totally different. And so, you know, it is up to people to make those individual choices. And sometimes it does cost more money. And sometimes people think it's worth it to pay that extra bit.
Here's an interesting point. Could the race toward digital actually lead us backwards to becoming illiterate as people lose writing skills, David?
You know what? I'm going to defer to Virginia because in her wonderful book, she talks a lot about, you know, reading
loss
and writing. Well, and also that there's a different kind of reading and writing that happens digitally. But I'll let her answer.
You know, I think that just as, you know, contempt for one technology is often allegiance to another technology, that, you know, that a resistance to or a love for a bygone prose style, you know, or say let's say writing itself is lost. Well, what do you make of Twitter? Twitter would be the perfect, that's not writing, it's subliterate, you know, it's beneath contempt. Reading text messages with their silly abbreviations is, you know, nothing could be worse. Nobody's reading Immanuel Kant in the original German with a German-English dictionary and so on. But, you know, tweets, for example, are Confucianisms, say, would take much, much fewer than 140 Chinese characters. And there's a great tradition of writing in epigrams, writing lyric poetry. Just because it's short doesn't mean it's profound. A beautiful, elegant tweet. And you can just look at some writers. Often they pin their best tweet, so the best tweet comes up at the top. You know, can be this excellently apposite, beautifully phrased tweet. It is writing.
And think about the haiku as
That's right.
an example of absolutely gorgeous writing. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David, we should not forget to mention that when television came along, everybody said radio was going to take the big hit. And look at where radio has gone.
And when film came along, everyone said the theater would be dead, right? Tried getting a ticket to Hamilton. Or I was at a wonderful play the other night in Toronto called Come From Away, which is heading to Broadway soon, completely sold out. The second that the first note hit, I was basically, you know, choking back tears the entire time. Because and I think this is the key thing here, is that, you know, once you're presented with that new technology, there's this that initial period of magic that Virginia is talking about, and the older technology seems, well, old and sort of it loses its value. And then I think what happens is after a period of time, you realize where what was sort of being lost, right? What is beneficial about that? Which is why, you know, Broadway sales are growing. And again, you know, even though podcasts are doing really well, and I wish you a lot of luck in your podcast,
Thank you.
Know, listenership for public radio is still strong.
Absolutely.
And you know, and it has an even more important voice.
All right, let's go to Eli in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
How are you guys?
Good.
Hi.
So I had a question, actually going back to sort of the beginning of the discussion regarding analog versus digital, and it's the question is referring to a 1950 paper that Alan Turing wrote called Computer Machinery and Intelligence. My question is, how do you think Alan Turing, his philosophical and mathematical materialism should be interpreted in the dichotomy between that of the digital and the analog?
What do you think, Virginia?
I have to admit something. I'm so immature that I was tweeting at David just now while we were talking, immature enough to think that's fun. And look at David. I can see him on Skype. He's not looking at Twitter at all.
My phone is
David
off.
David is fully analog, and I'm back in 2010 tweeting. I should defer to David on the question. I didn't hear it well.
I was deferring to you because you're the cultural studies and philosophy's PhD. I just did a Bachelor of Arts in something that I can barely remember. But I think, the dichotomy, as McLuhan said, one of the interesting things that I'll answer you, Eli, in a very abstract way that probably isn't what you wanted. But, you know, when I started researching this book, of course, I expected to hear sort of the love of analog and where it was growing from those in those industries, right? The people who are making vinyl records, bookstore owners, publishing people. And I did. The strongest response, and sometimes the one that was the most surprising, came from people who worked in the digital technology world. Engineers, coders, people who had startups, venture capitalists. I spent quite a bit of time out in Silicon Valley in San Francisco talking to people at Google and Facebook and Yelp and Twitter who not only believed in their personal lives that, you know, analog had a benefit and they went home to the very record collections that we're talking about in printing presses, but actually in those companies, they're integrating a lot of those analog processes into what they do in order to build better digital products. This is everything from sort of unplugged meditation sessions at Adobe to designers at Google using pen and paper as the first draft of everything they do.
Well, it has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you both so much. David Sachs's new book is called The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. Virginia Heffernan is the author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. Congrats to both of you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.